Chapter 16. Henry Plantagenet, when he was but 21 years old, quietly succeeded to the throne of England, according to his agreement made with the late king at Winchester. 6 weeks after Stephen's death, he and his queen, Eleanor, were crowned in that city, into which they rode on horseback in great state, side by side, amidst much shouting and rejoicing, and clashing of music, and strewing of flowers. The reign of King Henry II began well. The king had great possessions, and, what with his own rights, and what with those of his wife, was lord of one-third part of France. He was a young man of vigor, ability, and resolution, and immediately applied himself to remove some of the evils which had arisen in the last unhappy reign. He revoked all the grants of land that had been hastily made, on either side, during the late struggles. He obliged numbers of disorderly soldiers to depart from England. He reclaimed all the castles belonging to the crown, and he forced the wicked nobles to pull down their own castles, to the number of 1,100, in which such dismal cruelties had been inflicted on the people. The king's brother, Geoffrey, rose against him in France, while he was so well employed, and rendered it necessary for him to repair to that country, where, after he had subdued, and made a friendly arrangement with his brother who did not live long, his ambition to increase his possessions involved him in a war with the French king, Louis, with whom he had been on such friendly terms just before, that to the French king's infant daughter, then a baby in the cradle, he had promised one of his little sons in marriage, who was a child of 5 years old. However, the war came to nothing at last, and the Pope made the two kings friends again. Now, the clergy, in the troubles of the last reign, had gone on very ill indeed. There were all kinds of criminals among the murderers, thieves, and vagabonds. And the worst of the matter was, that the good priests would not give up the bad priests to justice, when they committed crimes, but persisted in sheltering and defending them. The king, well knowing that there could be no peace or rest in England, while such things lasted, resolved to reduce the power of the clergy, and, when he had reigned 7 years, found, as he considered, a good opportunity for doing so, in the death of the Archbishop of Canterbury. "I will have for the new archbishop," apostrophe thought the king, "a friend in whom I can trust, who will help me to humble these rebellious priests, and to have them dealt with, when they do wrong, as other men who do wrong are dealt with." Apostrophe so, he resolved to make his favorite, the new archbishop. And this favorite was so extraordinary a man, and his story is so curious, that I must tell you all about him. Once upon a time, a worthy merchant of London, named Gilbert à Becket, made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and was taken prisoner by a Saracen lord. This lord, who treated him kindly, and not like a slave, had one fair daughter, who fell in love with the merchant, and who told him that she wanted to become a Christian, and was willing to marry him if they could fly to a Christian country. The merchant returned her love, until he found an opportunity to escape, when he did not trouble himself about the Saracen lady, but escaped with his servant Richard, who had been taken prisoner along with him, and arrived in England and forgot her. The Saracen lady, who was more loving than the merchant, left her father's house in disguise to follow him, and made her way, under many hardships, to the seashore. The merchant had taught her only two English words, for I suppose he must have learnt the Saracen tongue himself, and made love in that language, of which London was one, and his own name, Gilbert, the other. She went among the ships, saying, "London, London," apostrophe over and over again, until the sailors understood that she wanted to find an English vessel that would carry her there. So they showed her such a ship, and she paid for her passage with some of her jewels, and sailed away. Well, the merchant was sitting in his counting house in London one day, when he heard a great noise in the street, and presently Richard came running in from the warehouse, with his eyes wide open and his breath almost gone, saying, "Master, master, here is the Saracen lady." Apostrophe, apostrophe, the merchant thought Richard was mad. But Richard said, "No, master. As I live, the Saracen lady is going up and down the city, calling Gilbert. Gilbert." Apostrophe then, he took the merchant by the sleeve, and pointed out of window, and there they saw her among the gables and water spouts of the dark, dirty street, in her foreign dress, so forlorn, surrounded by a wondering crowd, and passing slowly along, calling Gilbert, Gilbert. When the merchant saw her, and thought of the tenderness she had shown him in his captivity, and of her constancy, his heart was moved, and he ran down into the street, and she saw him coming, and with a great cry fainted in his arms. They were married without loss of time, and Richard, who was an excellent man, danced with joy the whole day of the wedding, and they all lived happy ever afterwards. This merchant and this Saracen lady had one son, Thomas a Becket. He it was who became the favorite of King Henry II. He had become chancellor when the king thought of making him archbishop. He was clever, gay, well-educated, brave, had fought in several battles in France, had defeated a French knight in single combat, and brought his horse away as a token of the victory. He lived in a noble palace, he was the tutor of the young Prince Henry, he was served by 140 knights, his riches were immense. The king once sent him as his ambassador to France, and the French people, beholding in what state he traveled, cried out in the streets, "How splendid must the King of England be, when this is only the Chancellor!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, they had good reason to wonder at the magnificence of Thomas a Becket, for, when he entered a French town, his procession was headed by 250 singing boys, then, came his hounds in couples, then, 8 wagons, each drawn by 5 horses driven by 5 drivers. 2 of the wagons filled with strong ale, to be given away to the people, 4, with his gold and silver plate and stately clothes, 2, with the dresses of his numerous servants. Then, came 12 horses, each with a monkey on his back, then, a train of people bearing shields, and leading fine war horses splendidly equipped, then, falconers with hawks upon their wrists, then, a host of knights, and gentlemen and priests, then, the chancellor with his brilliant garments flashing in the sun, and all the people capering and shouting with delight. The king was well pleased with all this, thinking that it only made himself the more magnificent, to have so magnificent a favorite, but he sometimes jested with the chancellor upon his splendor too. Once, when they were riding together through the streets of London in hard winter weather, they saw a shivering old man in rags. "Look at the poor object!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the king. "Would it not be a charitable act to give that aged man a comfortable warm cloak?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, undoubtedly it would, apostrophe, said Thomas a Becket, "and you do well, sir, to think of such Christian duties." Apostrophe, come. Apostrophe, cried the king, "then give him your cloak." Apostrophe, apostrophe, it was made of rich crimson trimmed with ermine. The king tried to pull it off, the chancellor tried to keep it on. Both were near rolling from their saddles in the mud, when the chancellor submitted, and the king gave the cloak to the old beggar. Much to the beggar's astonishment, and much to the merriment of all the courtiers in attendance. For, courtiers are not only eager to laugh when the king laughs, but they really do enjoy a laugh against a favorite. "I will make," apostrophe thought King Henry II, "this chancellor of mine, Thomas a Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury. He will then be the head of the church, and, being devoted to me, will help me to correct the church. He has always upheld my power against the power of the clergy, and once publicly told some bishops, I remember, that men of the church were equally bound to me with men of the sword. Thomas a Becket is the man, of all other men in England, to help me in my great design. apostrophe so the king, regardless of all objection, either that he was a fighting man, or a lavish man, or a courtly man, or a man of pleasure, or anything but a likely man for the office, made him archbishop accordingly. Now, Thomas A. Becket was proud, and loved to be famous. He was already famous for the pomp of his life, for his riches, his gold and silver plate, his wagons, horses, and attendants. He could do no more in that way than he had done, and being tired of that kind of fame, which is a very poor one, he longed to have his name celebrated for something else. Nothing, he knew, would render him so famous in the world as the setting of his utmost power and ability against the utmost power and ability of the king. He resolved with the whole strength of his mind to do it. He may have had some secret grudge against the king besides. The king may have offended his proud humor at some time or other, for anything I know. I think it likely, because it is a common thing for kings, princes, and other great people, to try the tempers of their favorites rather severely. Even the little affair of the crimson cloak must have been anything but a pleasant one to a haughty man. Thomas A. Becket knew better than anyone in England what the king expected of him. In all his sumptuous life, he had never yet been in a position to disappoint the king. He could take up that proud stand now, as head of the church, and he determined that it should be written in history, either that he subdued the king, or that the king subdued him. So, of a sudden, he completely altered the whole manner of his life. He turned off all his brilliant followers, ate coarse food, drank bitter water, wore next his skin sackcloth covered with dirt and vermin, for it was then thought very religious to be very dirty, flogged his back to punish himself, lived chiefly in a little cell, washed the feet of 13 poor people every day, and looked as miserable as he possibly could. If he had put 1,200 monkeys on horseback instead of 12, and had gone in procession with 8,000 wagons instead of 8, he could not have half astonished the people so much as by this great change. It soon caused him to be more talked about as an archbishop than he had been as a chancellor. The king was very angry, and was made still more so when the new archbishop, claiming various estates from the nobles as being rightfully church property, required the king himself, for the same reason, to give up Rochester Castle and Rochester City too. Not satisfied with this, he declared that no power but himself should appoint a priest to any church in the part of England over which he was archbishop. And when a certain gentleman of Kent made such an appointment, as he claimed to have the right to do, Thomas A. Becket excommunicated him. Excommunication was, next to the interdict I told you of at the close of the last chapter, the great weapon of the clergy. It consisted in declaring the person who was excommunicated an outcast from the church and from all religious offices, and in cursing him all over, from the top of his head to the sole of his foot, whether he was standing up, lying down, sitting, kneeling, walking, running, hopping, jumping, gaping, coughing, sneezing, or whatever else he was doing. This unchristian nonsense would of course have made no sort of difference to the person cursed who could say his prayers at home, if he were shut out of church, and whom none but God could judge, but for the fears and superstitions of the people, who avoided excommunicated persons, and made their lives unhappy. So, the king said to the new archbishop, "Take off this excommunication from this gentleman of Kent." Apostrophe to which the archbishop replied, "I shall do no such thing." Apostrophe, the quarrel went on. A priest in Worcestershire committed a most dreadful murder that aroused the horror of the whole nation. The king demanded to have this wretch delivered up, to be tried in the same court, and in the same way as any other murderer. The archbishop refused, and kept him in the bishop's prison. The king, holding a solemn assembly in Westminster Hall, demanded that in future all priests found guilty before their bishops of crimes against the law of the land should be considered priests no longer, and should be delivered over to the law of the land for punishment. The archbishop again refused. The king required to know whether the clergy would obey the ancient customs of the country. Every priest there, but one, said, after Thomas A. Becket, saving my order. Apostrophe this really meant that they would only obey those customs when they did not interfere with their own claims, and the king went out of the hall in great wrath. Some of the clergy began to be afraid now that they were going too far. Though Thomas A. Becket was otherwise as unmoved as Westminster Hall, they prevailed upon him, for the sake of their fears, to go to the king at Woodstock, and promise to observe the ancient customs of the country, without saying anything about his order. The king received this submission favorably, and summoned a great council of the clergy, to meet at the castle of Clarendon, by Salisbury. But when the council met, the archbishop again insisted on the word saying my order, apostrophe, and he still insisted, though lords entreated him, and priests wept before him, and knelt to him, and an adjoining room was thrown open, filled with armed soldiers of the king, to threaten him. At length he gave way, for that time, and the ancient customs which included what the king had demanded in vain, were stated in writing, and were signed and sealed by the chief of the clergy, and were called the Constitutions of Clarendon. The quarrel went on, for all that. The archbishop tried to see the king. The king would not see him. The archbishop tried to escape from England. The sailors on the coast would launch no boat to take him away. Then, he again resolved to do his worst in opposition to the king, and began openly to set the ancient customs at defiance. The king summoned him before a great council at Northampton, where he accused him of high treason, and made a claim against him, which was not a just one, for an enormous sum of money. Thomas A. Becket was alone against the whole assembly, and the very bishops advised him to resign his office, and abandon his contest with the king. His great anxiety and agitation stretched him on a sick bed for 2 days, but he was still undaunted. He went to the adjourned council, carrying a great cross in his right hand, and sat down holding it erect before him. The king angrily retired into an inner room. The whole assembly angrily retired, and left him there. But there he sat. The bishops came out again in a body, and renounced him as a traitor. He only said, I hear. Apostrophe and sat there still. They retired again into the inner room, and his trial proceeded without him. By and by, the Earl of Leicester, heading the barons, came out to read his sentence. He refused to hear it, denied the power of the court, and said he would refer his cause to the Pope. As he walked out of the hall, with the cross in his hand, some of those present picked up rushes. Rushes were strewn upon the floors in those days by way of carpet, and threw them at him. He proudly turned his head, and said that were he not archbishop, he would chastise those cowards with the sword he had known how to use in bygone days. He then mounted his horse, and rode away, cheered and surrounded by the common people, to whom he threw open his house, that night and gave a supper, supping with them himself. That same night he secretly departed from the town, and so, traveling by night and hiding by day, and calling himself Brother Dearman, apostrophe got away, not without difficulty, to Flanders. The struggle still went on. The angry king took possession of the revenues of the archbishopric, and banished all the relations and servants of Thomas A. Becket, to the number of 400. The Pope and the French king both protected him, and an abbey was assigned for his residence. Stimulated by this support, Thomas A. Becket, on a great festival day, formally proceeded to a great church crowded with people, and going up into the pulpit publicly cursed, and excommunicated all who had supported the Constitutions of Clarendon. Mentioning many English noblemen by name, and not distantly hinting at the King of England himself. When intelligence of this new affront was carried to the king in his chamber, his passion was so furious that he tore his clothes and rolled like a madman on his bed of straw and rushes. But he was soon up and doing. He ordered all the ports and coasts of England to be narrowly watched, that no letters of interdict might be brought into the kingdom, and sent messengers and bribes to the Pope's palace at Rome. Meanwhile, Thomas A. Becket, for his part, was not idle at Rome, but constantly employed his utmost arts in his own behalf. Thus the contest stood, until there was peace between France and England, which had been for some time at war, and until the two children of the two kings were married in celebration of it. Then, the French king brought about a meeting between Henry and his old favorite, so long his enemy. Even then, though Thomas A. Becket knelt before the king, he was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.